there's some food up at the tables there, and if you can stand it, I would like to read the story of the Meeker Massacre. While you're eating. No, it's a, there's not a whole lot of gore and guts in it. Well, I've condensed the story into four parts, and it's a condensation of The Last War Trail by Robert Emmett. He's a professor at the University of Oklahoma, a historian, and he wrote this in 1954. Really appreciated his deep research of the New Parka, and I hope this telling does him justice. 142 years ago in 1879, fortunes changed radically once again for the peaceful New Parka. The first European change came 400 years earlier with the introduction of a race of tall horses by the Quats, the Iron Shirts. Horses gave the mountain nooch the freedom to move easily over their rugged lands. And by 1877, Maricats, the white people that Nooch were sharing their land with, were now pushing west, hard, both by increasing Maricats' population and the forcing of a series of treaties that gave the people, the friendly Indians of Colorado, smaller and smaller tracts of land away from the Maricats' population. Colorado's friendly Utes were told that they had sovereignty over treaty lands, told that they would not be disturbed there, that food and clothing would be given to them in exchange for staying on their land and away from Washington's lands. Everything west of the Milk River and south of Rawlins, Wyoming was there, was theirs, and for reasons unexplained, in 1878, 1879, the presence of food, blankets, and clothes promised them were not forthcoming. Nathan Meeker was the agent at the White River Indian Agency, near present-day Meeker. He had freshly moved the agency onto the wintering grounds of the Yamparka, and with their now constrained lifestyle, in the harsh winters of 1878 and 9, the people relied on a presence from Washington. Yeah. Meeker didn't know the supplies were being held in a warehouse in Rawlins. The freight hadn't been paid because the bill hadn't been presented. Meeker had just moved from the utopian agricultural community that he'd founded. Union Colony was backed by Horace Greeley. It lay north of Denver at the confluence of the Cache la Poudre and the Platte Rivers, and prospered there. Meeker had taught the stabilizing effects of temperance, irrigation, and agriculture. Meeker now lived with his wife and his youngest 20-year-old daughter at the isolated White River Agency. Meeker had decided that civilizing the Utes meant teaching them Christianity and to plow their lands. At first, the Nooch tried to please Meeker and worked to plow fields as he directed, but the brown dirt turned over in even rows, reduced the amount of feed for their horses, and seemed unnatural. The total eclipses of the sun in July 1878 and then again on March 14th of 1879 planted a seed of doubt. The thought that plowing was disapproved by the spirit world. Part two. The year is 1879, and Indian agent Meeker, a renowned national authority on agriculture, is becoming frustrated by the slowing progress of the civilizing of the Indians. The volunteer Ute plowmen and ditch diggers, the Chief Douglas or Quinquent, had organized were not showing up. So Meeker requested a budget from Governor Pitkin to hire white people to plow the winter range of the Nooch at a faster rate. Governor Pitkin had campaigned with the slogan, "The Utes must go," and the money to hire came quickly. Meeker had given a few of the chief's land parcels on a surveyed grid for a town he had laid out on their winter range. This was to entice them to cooperate, and now he was plowing that up. He wished to consolidate the fencing necessary to keep Indian horses out of the irrigated fields. Meeker even plowed up the racetrack where the horses raced during the Great Bear Dance gathering in the spring. Resentment built amongst the people. As it glowed hotter, Meeker threatened that the army would send the bad people to prison to live in chains without the sun. This fanned even more resentment, and now fear grew amongst the last of the freedmen of Burka. Many people were camped there that fall because that was a season that the presents Washington promised was usually arrived at the White River Agency just west of the mouth of Coal Creek Canyon on the smoking Earth River, or White River. One day, Agent Meeker sent a man to plow the fields of Cavendish. The Mitsut Tikkwat, or healer of the people, Cavendish went to Meeker to ask why his field was being plowed. He told Meeker that he did not want his field plowed, reminding Meeker that he had given it to him. And as they talked, the people waited for the late presence, gathered around and listened. Cavendish pressed the point resolutely that he did not wish his field plowed. Meeker retorted that the Indian Council, 2 days before, had agreed that he, Washington, could plow any ground, anything that he wanted. Meeker was backing up to get space between them until he backed into a log on the ground and fell over. He heard a chorus of laughter from the people who had been tuned by hardship to love a joke. The next day, a plowman caught the glint of the sun off of a rifle 200 feet away, and he felt a shot fired past him. He packed his things and left the next day. Meeker had been humiliated, and now fearful, he wrote the governor on September 10th, 1879, about the assaults, asking for soldiers to be sent. The request, bolstered by Governor Pitkin and the speed of the telegraph, flew up the chain of command to the Secretary of the Interior due to the importance of the land involved to coal and mining interests. On September 29th, a detachment of 190 soldiers led by Major Thornburg pressed out of Rawlins to enter Indian land to the south. The people had never had soldiers on their land, but Nikagat could speak to the soldiers. He was raised from infancy by Mormons until he left them in anger as a 13-year-old. He joined the Smoking Earth River Band of Yamparta many years before. Nikagat knew what had happened to the Cheyenne and Sioux when he acted as a guide for the army on those campaigns. Nikagat was inspired by the thought of peace to ride out and tell the soldiers not to cross the Milk River onto their land. And the young men, hot and roused, decided to follow. Part 3. On a cool September 28th in 1879, Nikagat, intent on maintaining peace between the Nooch and the Maricats, found Major Thornburg and his detachment on the Williams Fork, a day's ride off the reservation. That evening he spoke to him. Thornburg was receptive to the thought that it would shatter the peace if he was to bring his soldiers onto Nooch land. Nikagat asked Thornburg to come with him, bring only a few soldiers to see that there was no problem at the White River Agency. But the major was dissuaded by his esteemed guide from Rawlins, Joe Rankin, dressed in a fresh buckskin suit with elaborate fringing. He was suspicious of the motives of the Nikagat. The next day, 190 men and 25 supply wagons marched forward toward the White River Agency. Thornburg thought to cross the Milk River, a major obstruction, and camp his troops nearer to the agency for quicker support. At the agency, Quinkent, an elder of influence, hearing of the soldiers coming, talked to Meeker. He asked for a paper to take to Thornburg, saying not to bring his soldiers onto Nooch land. Meeker refused. Quinkent then asked that Meeker go with him to meet the soldiers, to tell of the peace in the camps. Again, he was refused. Colero, a round-bellied Nooch who had made himself known by visiting settlers in North and Middle Park and asking himself to sit in on meals with them, also visited Thornburg. Colero, too, pressed the importance of not bringing soldiers onto the land given to the Nooch by Washington. Again, the scout, Joe Rankin, made Thornburg doubt. Thornburg marched on the morning of September 30th. As the orderly line of soldiers approached and began crossing the difficult ford at Milk River and onto the agency lands, a young Ute fired his rifle. It was impossible for Thornburg to stop the soldiers from returning fire, and in a heartbeat, a son of Cavendish had fallen. As the conflict increased, Nikagat took aim and fired a shot. Thornburg rose in his shadow and fell to the ground, losing their leader through the troops in the confusion until the 25 wagons broke out of the canyon and circled in a defense formation. All the soldiers and their horses were brought into the wagon fort. It was about 50 Nooch that had gone to meet the soldiers. A few had fallen. The Nooch, knowing that soldiers would ride out for reinforcements when the dark came, had an awful job ahead of them. One by one, they shot the horses, exploding the fort in mad confusion as they bucked and reared, but soon all were dead. Now, only a few of the Nooch needed to stay and fire occasionally at the wagons to keep the soldiers pinned down in their hole. The next day, a detachment of black soldiers arrived and had their horses shot out from under them also. The Buffalo soldiers took on the duties of leaving the fort to haul water for the river and drag the bloated, stinking horse carcasses out of the wagons and bury them. Seeing they were not there to fight, Nooch left the Tomaricats, or black-faced white soldiers, alone to do their work. 25 warriors had returned to the agency the day of the attack, and they killed the 7 white men there, then set about breaking their carnage, their teepees, to take their women and children to a winter camp. The 3 Maricots women were brought along as hostages. They were protected by the Nooch women as they moved south and west. The Maricots each became Piwan to a man and were encouraged to submit by the women of the people. Part 4. On October 4th in 1879, riding hard for 3 days from Los Pinos Agency, south of Delta, the Maricots, Salvampero, Oray's brother, and 14 southern chiefs brought a letter from Oray telling the Nooch to stop hostilities. A second letter from the W.M. Stanley Indian agent at Los Pinos sent to the soldiers asking them to stop all hostilities was read by Nikaga. Many young men had died and were being covered by early snow. The heat had gone from the fight, and a white flag was located and raised. Like magic, the shooting stopped. Soldiers that were crawling up the hill with long rifles towards the Indians and camped above stood and returned to the wagons. Joseph Brady, who had come with Sapanero, rode down and delivered Stanley's letter to General Merritt, who grudgingly let the Ute go. One by one, the warriors turned to leave, returning to their women and Carniv, thinking to head south to the land of the people. It took 23 days to ransom the white women and a year to hear the military tribunals in Los Pinos about the deaths at the agency and the Indians incident at Milk River. Though most of the elders present at the trials have been present at the conflicts, none have been accused by the women hostages. The tribunal demanded to have the accused brought in. Oray, angered by the demand of General Hatch and the suggestion of utter destruction of the Ute and forfeiture of treaty lands, had come with it, declaring himself an enemy of the whites, and insisted that none of the accused would be tried in Colorado. They would only submit to a trial in Washington. The tribunal acquiesced, and in January of 1880, it loaded the group into the wagons and headed east through Alamosa. At Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, Quinquent, known as Douglas, was imprisoned. He was the only accused named by the hostages who had come to the tribunal. He had been inspired to help his people. The remainder went on to Washington for a congressional investigation, where the story of the Indian uprising and massacre was repeated again. Congress sent a commission to Colorado to deal with the Utes definitively. By June 21st, 1880, the commission had collected signatures from enough of the Colorado Indian bands on a treaty turning their land over to Washington that the military could escort the people off their land at gunpoint. In the end, it was the reality of force and death that guided the decision of the brave Nooch to leave the land they loved at the will of the Maricots. Oray led the surrender, understanding the inevitable cost and impossibility of resistance, and the people in trust followed his guidance. The surrender was an act that cost him his life. He died of sorrow on August 28, 1880, filled with the loss of his beloved. His people moved to the reservation of the Northern Ute by Split Mountain on the Green River, thinking of themselves as the White River Nooch. Here in Carbondale, we know of the Nooch curse to remind us of the power and the fairness of the Ute. The curse states that no person born in these valleys may leave permanently unless a small amount of sand is collected from along the Gunnison and Colorado rivers. The sand alleviates the curse's supernatural effect on attraction by the valley soil to the native individual. There is an ancient presence here of the culture that came before, but few Nooch live here now. We only have a void stretching back 9,000 years, according to an archaeological find in Emma. So this is our time, our chance to touch history. We now have Nooch Park to honor their love and touch upon the land. The park should be landscaped in native permaculture, planted with chokecherry, sarvusberry, yampa, rose currant, rosebud, currant, pin cherry, wild plum, Oregon grape, and thimbleberry. We can also atone by acknowledging the forced evacuation that validates our ownership. And we can accept the Nooch Band in 1880 back to their home. Doing so, we reclaim our humanity and the wholeness of ourselves. Thank you. So as we know, you can't really say sorry. It doesn't mean much if you have a brother or a sister, you know, punch you in the shoulder and they'll say, "Oh, I'm sorry." Sure. And then they'll hit you again and you say, "I'm sorry." Sorry is meaningless. It's atonement. Atonement, when we atone for our actions, we mean that we won't do it again. And we're not there yet. We can't atone for our actions because we do it again and again and again, and we're doing it now. And unless we atone each personally, and maybe there's 100 monkeys out there of us, and maybe there's a chance that when enough of us atone that our nation will atone, our people will atone, and we'll stop razzing and murdering and taking advantage of anyone that we can take advantage of. Well, that time is yet to come, but We need to try. We need to keep working at it. That's our duty. And thank you all for coming here today to participate in my own personal atonement to Mooch and all of the people. We have such a bad thing with. So we love them, we're grateful for them, and we admire their culture and their talent. Thank you.